So if you guys recall, we're talking about Samuel, and we're talking about David in the book of Samuel, and we're looking at the characteristics of David that make him a man after God's own heart. We've learned several things already in the first half of 1 Samuel, right? We learned about David being a shepherd. We learned about David winning over Jonathan as a friend. We talked about how David was always one that brought people to him. People were attracted to who he was. We talked about him being a servant leader. He had incredible servant leadership traits, and he demonstrated that throughout his life. Then we also learned about Saul and how Saul, at first, was a fan of David. He brought David in. And then as soon as David started becoming famous and people started believing in David more than Saul, Saul started to act crazy. He started to play mind games with David. And so just like this video, these people did absolutely nothing wrong, and all of a sudden there's people out looking for him. And that's what we're going to talk about today, because that's how the story begins to continue in 1 Samuel. So today we're going to be in 1 Samuel 21. Last week we finished 1 Samuel 20. So kind of the conclusion of chapter 20 was this. We learned that Saul was out to kill David, not because of anything that David did wrong. In fact, David loved Saul. He loved Jonathan. He was very loyal to Saul. And he doesn't believe David's sitting here going, I can't grasp that Saul wants to kill me. What have I ever done to him? I fought his battles. I took care of him. I took care of the people of Israel. And so Jonathan goes back and he says, look, I'm going to check with my dad and figure out if he's really trying to kill you. And if he is, I'll let you know. Well, Jonathan finds out that Saul really has this thing out for David. He wants to kill him. Jonathan goes out and secretly tells David. They make an oath together. And now David flees. So he goes from shepherd to this hero that slayed Goliath, to this person who people were chanting about. David killed tens of thousands. The armor bearer of the king, a close associate with the king. He was a commander of armies. He goes from all of that, including being anointed as the future king of Israel by Samuel, to now he is a fugitive. He's a fugitive. He finds out that Saul and his corrupt self is after David. So now David goes on the run, and the carpet is pulled from underneath him. How many of you have read the Psalms before, at least some of the Psalms? David wrote a good chunk of those Psalms that we read in the Bible. And when you read it, it's like a roller coaster ride. It's like one day David's up, one day David's down. One day he's up, one day he's down. Well, if you take the Psalms and you overlay them onto the life of David, you begin to understand why. His mind was being played with by Saul. These were all games that Saul began to play with David. So let's take a look at 1 Samuel 21, verse 1. I have somebody that might like to read that. 1 Samuel 21, verse 1.
Mm-hmm. David went to Ahimelech, the priest at Nob. Ahimelech was afraid to meet David. So he said to him, Why are you alone and no one is with you?
Thank you. So notice the first place that David goes. When you study about Nob, it was actually a holy place, and there was a temple there, and there was a priest there, and the first place David runs to for refuge is a place of God. He goes to a church, if you will, and seeks guidance from a priest. All right, David's in a place in his life where he's not sure who he can trust. People that he thought were his friends seem to be betraying him now. He thought Saul was a fan of David's, and yet he's finding out he really wants to kill him. And so who can he trust? Where can he go? Where's the best place to seek refuge? And he goes to the house of the Lord, and he talks to a priest. I read this, and I put it in modern-day context. Anybody ever had trouble in their life? Anybody been in a situation where you weren't sure what to do? Anybody been in a situation like them where all of a sudden this fear comes over you? And it's fight or flight? What do we do in those situations? I think David gives us a good example. He turns to the Lord in all things. He turns to the Lord. He goes to a place of refuge. He knows that God is his refuge. You read it in the Psalms, he says it all the time. So I think the Psalms give us a better picture of David's heart than anything else. But he goes to this place of refuge. David wrote in Psalm 9:9, "The Lord is a refuge for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble." When we get in these situations, how many of you turn to prayer first? A lot of times we don't, do we? A lot of times we try and solve these problems. We go to great lengths to figure out how we can solve them. And we don't turn to God. We don't turn to the first place of refuge that we should turn to. He's the first person we should go. He is the Almighty, the one that can solve every problem in your life, or at least get you through those problems. Sometimes you're in those problems because he wants you in those problems to learn something. Do we turn to God? How many have read the story of Jonah? I wrote a little devotional about it a few weeks ago. Jonah was given instruction from the Lord. He didn't want to do it, and so he flees. He runs. He ends up getting swallowed up by a whale, and for 3 days he refused to turn to God and ask for help. We call that pride, right? Jonah had so much pride, he was afraid to turn to God for help. When he finally did, the whale spits him out, and Jonah finally agrees, "I'm going to do what God told me." It's very similar in our walk, especially for guys, I think. When we're in trouble, we try and fix things ourselves. We're fixers. Guys want to fix stuff. And I know there are some women that way too, but guys primarily, you tell us a problem, we want to solve it. That's just how we're wired. We don't turn to God and ask him, the creator of all things, to solve the problem. We try to do it ourselves. We should learn this about David. In all situations, we need to turn to the Lord and trust him in these situations and give them to him. He tells us to do so. Now, we begin to see a little flaw in David's character as we move forward in this story. Would somebody like to read 1 Samuel 21:2?
I will.
Okay.
"And David said to Ahimelech the priest, 'The king has charged me with a matter and said to me, let no one know anything of the matter about which I have sent you and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place.'"
Okay, is that true?
Nope.
That's not true, is it? David's lying to the priest now, isn't he? David is fabricating a story to cover up the mess he's in. He doesn't know who he can trust, whether he can trust the priest or not, so he's lying to him. David's on the run. He's trying to figure out what to do. He's trying to figure out who he can go to get supplies so he can go hide out and be a refugee, or not a refugee, but a fugitive. And so he goes to the priest, and he lies to him. And so far we've read about this great character, David, and now we start to see a flaw, right? He's trying to cover his own skin right now. He's trying to look out for his own interest. He lies to save his own neck. As we've been going through the last couple of weeks, one of the things I've done is done a lot of research in psychology and fear. And I've learned this term that they use, flight or fight, or fight or flight. And it explains exactly how the brain is wired. And when you're under fear and you're under pressure, how your brain, how certain parts of your brain literally change due to chemical changes. And you begin to get this anxiety, and you begin to see things in your mind that may not even be real. That's what happens when the emotion of fear comes over us. Now, it's to protect us, but sometimes it goes way too far. And it causes us to do irrational things. And I'm looking at a man, David, going, he's got to be under great stress right now. He has no idea who he can trust other than God. And he does trust God, as we'll learn. And he's running for his life. Well, the character flaws with David continue. Would you guys like to look at 1 Samuel 21, 3 through 4 now? Is that someone that might read that? Those two verses?
All right.
Okay.
Now therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be done. The priest answered David and said, there is no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread. If only the young men have kept themselves from women.
All right, thank you. So, I don't know if you guys know this, but in the book of Leviticus, God gave Moses a law about the consecrated bread to be used in service. In Leviticus 22, and I'll read this to you guys. Beginning with verse 10, it says, no one outside a priest's family may eat the sacred offering, nor may the guest of a priest or his hired work eat it. But if a priest buys a slave with money, or if slaves are born in the household, they may eat his food. If a priest's daughter marries anyone other than a priest, she may not eat any of the sacred contributions. But if a priest's daughter becomes a widow or is divorced, yet has no children, and she returns to live in her father's household, as in her youth, she may eat her father's food. No unauthorized person, however, may eat it. Okay? Then it says, anyone who eats a sacred offering by mistake must make retribution to the priest for the offering and add a fifth of the value to it. The priest must not desecrate the sacred offering the Israelites present to the Lord by allowing them to eat the sacred offering and so bring upon them guilt requiring payment. I am the Lord who makes him holy. Okay, this is very clear. Priests knew what this bread was for. It was an offering to God, and it wasn't to be eaten by just anybody. Now, there's another verse in Levitical I want to look up real quick. And this is 24:8 through 9. It says, this bread is to be set out before the Lord regularly, Sabbath after Sabbath, on behalf of the Israelites, as a lasting covenant. It belongs to Aaron and his sons, who are to eat it in the sanctuary area, because it is a most holy part of their perpetual share of the food offerings presented to the Lord. Okay, so again, it's very clear that this consecrated bread was meant to be used for specific purposes, right? And the priest knew what these regulations were. And so the only thing the priest does is he says, as long as your men have kept themselves from the women. That's his only requirement here. Now, I read quite a bit of commentary on this to say, okay, was the priest wrong? Was David wrong? Who was wrong in the situation? Well, both of them were, to be honest with you. David knew what the bread was for. The priest knew what the bread was for. Now, many have argued that this bread was actually old stale bread that had been removed from the presence of the Lord, and a fresh loaf of bread was put in front of the presence of the Lord, and the priests were allowed to eat it after the Sabbath. That was their, they were allowed to partake in that. But it was very clear that not just anybody could partake in it. And so here we have the situation where David lies to the priest. The priest allows David to have this consecrated bread. They both knew that was wrong. And so we have these things going on with David's character that we start to question now, right? How could this be a man after God's own heart? Many people struggle with these verses. They're like, okay, in David's situation, was it okay for him to do what he did? You know, I remember growing up and as a child, if I did something wrong, there were times where I tried to justify it any way I could, right? Make up excuses for why this was okay, why I had to do this wrong. And what did my parents usually say? A wrong never makes up. Two wrongs never make up a right, right? So it's you know, it's the same old cliche here that David has consequences for his actions. And he knew it was wrong. But I want to show something that's even more important. I want to shed some light on this. Do I have somebody that would turn to Matthew 12 for me and look at verse 1 through 8? Thank you.
12:1-8.
Yes, please.
At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath day through the corn, and his disciples were hungered and began to pluck the ears of corn and to eat. When the Pharisees saw it, they said unto him, Behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day. But he said unto them, Have you not read what David did when he was hungered, and they that were with him? How he entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priest. Or have you not read in the law how that on the Sabbath days the priest in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple. But if ye had not known what this meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, ye would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day.
Thank you. That's an important thing to be reminded. Jesus gives us very good clarifications on the law. The law was never meant to bring condemnation. But what happened is your Jewish leadership establishment at this time used it to bring condemnation. They use it to lord themselves over others. And what Jesus has said is, I demand mercy, not sacrifice. This was a time where God showed great mercy. You don't see anything happen to David or anything happen to this priest due to the situation. The priest was showing God's mercy to David. He allowed him to have what he needed. Later on, Jesus talks about the Sabbath and says the Sabbath is for man, is meant for men. It was a day of rest. And there are many, many other scriptures within the New Testament and the Gospels where Jesus specifically talks about it's not the letter of the law. It's about the reason for the law and what it was meant to do. And so too often, we get caught up on, well, he broke this law. There's a law that's much greater. It's called the law of mercy, the law of love that God demonstrates many times. David was in a desperate situation and God showed him mercy. David still had a plan. God had a plan for David. We look at that and we go, oh, you sinner, how could you do that? And you'll see that there are many instances where David breaks out a character out of stress. He breaks out a character because the world is coming after him and he doesn't know what to do. And that's a natural humanistic thing to do, right? I know God's on my side, but when I'm put in a corner, we start to do irrational stuff, right? Doesn't make it right. It just means David was human. He was very human. I don't know if you guys remember, but a while back we talked about Solomon. He said, mercy is to be preferred to sacrifice. The ritual observances must give way to moral duties. If we don't keep that in mind, we become a person or a people that condemn instead of show God's mercy. You know, Jesus said many times that, you know, take the plank out of your own eye before you take the sliver out of somebody else's eye. You read about them all the time calling people hypocrites. And this is one of those situations where we can look at David and we can be hypocritical, or we can understand why he did what he did and move on. And God obviously showed mercy in this situation. Now let's continue to 1 Samuel 21. We're going to read 5 through 6. And a lot of what today is setting the stage for the next few chapters. Because the next few chapters, we're going to see some really important characteristic traits of David. 1 Samuel 21, 5 through 6. Do I have someone that might read those two verses? Okay.
And David answered the priest, "Surely women have been kept from us. As always when I go on an expedition, the vessels of the young men are holy, even when it is an ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy?" So the priest gave him holy bread. For there was no bread there, but the bread of the presence, which is removed from before the Lord to be replaced by hot bread on the day it is taken away.
Thank you. So there's another indication there that the priest didn't go take this from the altar and offer it to David. They had already made a new offering to God, took the old offering, and the priests were allowed to use it. And it said, if you have a slave, it shows you the heart of God. In those whole verse in Leviticus, God was looking out for the needy. He said, if there's a person that's in need, help them out. Don't just say, no, we got this stale bread, we're going to throw it away, you can't eat it. Yes.
Do you think that, obviously God's not going to eat the bread that they put on the altar, but do you think he made that law just to make sure that they were taking care of the slaves and the needy so that they would be inclined to continually give that bread out to people?
I think he was taking care of the priests. Because the priests were the one tribe in Israel that could not have an inheritance. All the other tribes were allowed inheritance. So the priests were usually taken care of by the rest of Israel. And God made provisions for them to be able to be fed and taken care of. And so that's what I think it was for. But that's a great question, Sandra. There are other places within Leviticus that you'll read in Deuteronomy where God says if an Israelite is walking through a field of grain, allow them to pluck the grain and eat it, but they must not pull up the grain, meaning take what you need to fulfill yourself, but then leave the rest of the grain alone. And that was supposed to be permitted. So God was always looking out for those that were in need, providing for everybody, not just for certain people. And so you look at that, and then you go back and you look at some of the other texts, and it's like, you guys are missing how merciful God is in the law. He's very merciful.
Well, I think we have a higher calling. If we know someone's stealing because they can't feed their family, It's our higher calling to forgive them and to help them feed that family, you know? And I think that's where that Matthew verse ties in with us.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Tying into that, in the Mosaic Law, you were only allowed to reap 90% of your fields because you had to leave some for the poor and the needy.
That's absolutely right.
So that's God, guys. That's He provides. He provides. You know, there have been times where I've talked to people that were in need, including myself at times, and they don't realize that God continues to keep them alive, continues to provide food. We don't always get what we want, But God gives us what we need. And that's an important lesson. You know, we get mad and blame God. Well, I was starving and you didn't help me. Well, I dropped this coupon for Burger King right in your lap and you didn't like Burger King. I mean, we have to wake up and recognize what God does. Now let's continue on to 1 Samuel 21:7. Okay?
Now one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. He was Doeg, the Edomite, Saul's head shepherd.
Thank you. So we have this new character introduced. He's a very important person under Saul's authority. And he's not of the Jewish descent. He's an Edomite. And so you have this guy at the temple. And so if you look at that, you're like, okay, he's not Jewish. What's he doing at the temple? And why is the Lord holding him up there? And what's his role in this whole story of David? What many believe is that he was a proselyte. He became a Jew. That in a service in the Jewish community, he learned the Jewish traditions and became a Jew. And most likely he was there serving some obligation in the temple at that time. But the thing that's really important to understand is this guy is an outsider. Okay, they brought him in and he's now working for Saul in a high up position, to be honest with you. And we see that Doeg is a name that I want you to remember because he plays a really important role as we go into the next few chapters in the next few weeks. Now, would somebody like to read 1 Samuel 21:8?
Then David said to Ahimelech, "Then have you not? This is like super small. Then you have not here a spear or a sword at hand, for I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business requires haste."
Thank you. Okay, now we see a little white lie. It's true, he didn't bring his sword or his weapon. What part of that's a lie? He's trying to say the king sent me in such an urgency that I didn't have time to grab my stuff. Okay, so he's building upon this. Do you have a question, Senator? Okay. So now what happens is David gets his sword. The priest gives him, guess which sword? Goliath's sword. Okay? He gives him Goliath's sword. It's a mighty sword. And so now David has eaten. He's got a sword. He's got his belongings, and now he's going into he's going to continue to go hide from Saul. David's obviously very smart, and he's very connected. He's got a reputation at this point in time. People know who he is. There are rumors about this great man that's killed tens of thousands. Anybody ever seen the movie with Mel Gibson? Braveheart. See how the reputation about Braveheart grows and grows and grows, and people start talking about this man as he's some myth, and then he shows up, and they're like, "You're not Braveheart." It's very similar, I think, about David in this period in time. He's grown in reputation, and people know who he is, and they fear him, believe it or not. They fear him because he's such a mighty warrior, but they respect him, and they love him. What you'll learn is everywhere he goes, people follow him. And I think the key to that whole reason people follow him is because he's always putting their interest before his own. Saul's the opposite. Saul's looking out for himself. So now if we look at verses 10 through 11. Somebody want to read those two?
I will. "And David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Mm-hmm. And the servants of Achish said unto him, Is not this David the king of the land? Did they not sing one to another of him in dances, saying, Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000s?
He's got a reputation, doesn't he? Doesn't need Facebook. I mean, the word spread about David. People know who he is. The fact that people recognize him, they must have seen him in battle or knew who he was. But what's interesting is he's now running off out of Saul's kingdom into other kingdoms that are usually considered enemies of Saul. So he goes to the king of Gath. And what we're going to learn is that once they find out who David is, he starts to do some other wacky stuff. All right? So let's look at verse 12 through 15, and we're almost done. Somebody want to read 12 through 15? Okay.
Well, David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them, pretended madness and heaviness, scratched on the doors of the gate, and let a saliva fall down in his beard. And Achish said to his servants, "Look, you see this man is insane. Why have you brought him to me? If I needed a madman, that you have brought this fellow to call the madman in my presence?
You guys getting the picture here? So I read these verses and it reminded me of what we just saw in that airport. Bless you. Right, where you're sitting here thinking nobody knows who you are, nobody recognizes you, and all of a sudden all these fingers start pointing at you. And he's a wanted man. And then Gath is, you know, thinking this guy has come in here to spy or he's come in here to bring his armies in. David was, you know, feared by many of the local kings. And so these guys start pointing at David, and he starts to do what? He starts to act nuts. Huh? Or flee the fifth? I mean, I can only imagine. Who would come up with that?
But with him being as famous as he was, would the king not have recognized him right away?
Probably not, unless the king, you know, had dealt with David directly. All right. Yeah, I mean, the newspaper wasn't delivered yet. Yes, sir.
What strikes me is he's carrying Goliath's sword in the land of Goliath.
That's true, that's true. That's a very good point.
It's not like that would not be right.
So this is how the story of David closes in this chapter, okay? I was really wanting to do chapter 22. I'm going to leave that for next week, but this is kind of a precursor to it. Next week, we will begin to really explore the character of David. You'll get to see a true hero come out of this situation. You know, David had everything going for him. He was a handsome man. We read about that. He was married to the king's daughter. He was known for killing this giant, Goliath. He was given a responsibility under the king. He was a commander of armies. And all of a sudden, he becomes a fugitive. Becomes a fugitive. First place he goes for refuge is where? Priest, to God's house, right? To the temple. He goes to God. The other thing is that we begin to see some shortcomings in the story of David. When he's under pressure, he begins to do some silly things. There is nothing in this chapter that I can apply in terms of character traits that I would like to instill in you today. But beginning next week, there's going to be quite a few. But I want to set the stage so that you understand the situation David is in. I don't know any of you that have been on the run before. I can imagine that that is a scary place to be. You're looking over your shoulders. You're in hiding all the time. People are out to get you. There's probably a bounty on his head. You know, it doesn't go into all these details, but you can imagine, right? If America's Most Wanted was on today, David's picture would be on there, right? And people recognize him. And so this guy is on the run for his life. And we're going to begin to see, even under the run, how David manages to rise up to the occasion, and you begin to see this incredible servant leader come out of this. All right, let me close this there. Let's pray.